This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week's marks 84 years since the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, that day that will live in infamy, that many Americans still picture as a brilliantly planned, flawlessly executed, treacherous surprise attack. And here's how the newsreels from 1941 reported the attack to American moviegoers.
On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards. Costly to our Navy was the loss of war vessels, airplanes, and equipment, but more costly to Japan was the effectiveness of its foul attack in immediately unifying America in its determination to fight and win the war thrust upon it, and to win the peace that will follow. The Japs copied their German masters in striking hard at airfields. Hickam Field, northwest of Honolulu, and the Ford Island Naval Plane Base were the first objectives of Japan's treachery. Scores of planes were bruised and battered by the Japs' aerial bombs. Many of these were demolished beyond repair. Direct hits were scored on hangars, and these were badly shattered. Equipment and airplane supplies were reduced to smoldering ruins. Here at the Naval Air Station is grim and positive evidence of Jap treachery. Here, foul blows were struck while Jap diplomats were talking peace in Washington.
Now, over eight decades later, a new book, Pearl Harbor, Japan's Greatest Disaster, by naval historian Mark E. Steele, argues that the attack was not a strategic masterstroke, but a deeply flawed plan carried out with serious mistakes. And it's now time to finally set that record straight. Mark E. Steele, welcome to The Source.
I'm glad to be here, David.
Tell me what people should get right about this. What are the mistakes, the misinformation, myths about Pearl Harbor?
Well, that lead-in account there was pretty good, actually. It does trace a lot of the central themes of the event. But even so, there's a lot of mythology and misunderstandings about the event, 84 years after the attack. So among the many myths that are covered in this book, would be the one that concerns the pre-war negotiations. There's been some accounts recently that have talked about how war could have been averted in the months before Pearl Harbor, and that's just not true. There's still a lot of mythology about the central figure behind the attack, and that's Japanese Admiral Yamamoto. Many accounts paint him as a man of peace and a great strategist. Again, that is totally ill-founded and covered in great detail in the book. And that lead-in talked about, or your lead-in talked about, how the attack was brilliantly planned and brilliantly executed. And that is a central theme in almost every account of the battle. And if you look at how the attack was planned over the span of many months, you'll see that it was not well planned in all regards. I mean, obviously the Japanese did achieve total surprise, and they did inflict a lot of damage, so it wasn't like the attack was not well planned, but parts of it were not well planned, when you look at the details. And the notion that it was well executed, that's probably the central theme of the book, because the book is primarily a military account of the battle. So I look in great detail there about the first and second wave attacks, and once you do that, you find that the first wave attack underperformed in a lot of ways. The second wave attack was an utter fiasco as far as the Japanese were concerned. It achieved very little for the Japanese. Other parts of the battle, too, are overlooked. People probably are aware that there was a component of the Japanese attack involved midget subs in the harbor, which was also a total failure. But the Japanese submarine attack was much, much bigger than that, and that's overlooked, and it's also covered in the book because that was, again, a total failure. But a central theme in most books, most accounts of the battle, is how it crippled the American fleet. And as you kind of mentioned in your lead-in there, the attack didn't have a big impact on American capabilities, either in the short run or in the long run. So there's a lot to cover there because there's still a lot of mythology about the battle.
You have to say that, okay, away from the tactics of the day and how well they were executed, but the grand strategy, you have to say, what was Japan thinking about launching this attack on Pearl Harbor. And didn't they recognize that they were taking on the United States, something that they didn't have to do, and they brought the U.S. into the war in both theaters, Europe and the Pacific? But it seemed like, well, you know, they really poked the bear, and they brought the full might and will against Japan, not only in fighting the war, maybe you could say the war was inevitable, but doing the sneak attack in this way, they brought about the United States that was going to demand a complete and total surrender of Japan. And so you have to say that was a mistake.
That was a colossal mistake. And this should have been known to the Japanese before the event, but they really didn't think it through. They had this loose idea about a path to victory. But here again, we have to talk about the role of Yamamoto, because without him, there was no Pearl Harbor attack. It's his idea that drove the attack into being. And he had the notion that the attack was going to be that there are two parts of the attack as far as he was concerned. One was the military aspects of it. He was going to cripple the American fleet by sinking battleships. And then there's the psychological aspect to it. And this is overlooked most often, because he thought that by sinking battleships, because at the time they were the measure of naval power, so if he sank enough battleships, he could cripple American morale. And that was obviously totally unfounded. So here's a man who lived in America twice, who people think had this great insight into America and Americans, who had this totally flawed notion that he could cripple American morale by sinking battleships. So that gets into their strategic miscalculation. And if you look at their plan for victory, and this is not just Yamamoto, it's the overall Japanese plan for victory, it really was founded on the notion that after some period of pounding against Japanese defenses, after they had taken what they had to take in Southeast Asia to create a viable wartime economy, so after the Americans got tired of trying to take back those newly gained conquests, that then there would be some possibility of a negotiated peace to Japan's favor at some point. But obviously, when you conduct this treacherous, unprovoked attack that takes a high toll of American lives and American sovereign territory, that undermines your notion there that you're going to gain some negotiated peace at some future point in the war.
So was Japan, you know, they always say you're fighting the previous war when you're planning the next war. Was Japan actually basing this psychology on what happened when they fought Russia in 1904? They launched a surprise sneak attack against Russia in Port Arthur. They smashed the Russian fleet there. And then they eventually were able to get a negotiated peace where they gained territory.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. It's true. And again, since Yamamoto was the driving force behind the attack, we got to look at how he thought about it. And he was fully aware of how the Japanese opened the Russo-Japanese War. He thought it was a brilliant idea, but it wasn't conducted with enough resolution. They didn't carry it out as far as they should have. So, yes, that was definitely in his mind to do it the same way. And the Americans were also aware of the Japanese penchant for surprise attacks, and also the Axis powers, the Germans, had shown this during the Second World War, how they attacked without a declaration of war. And in fact, Washington advised the commanders on Oahu that you better be on your guard, because this is how an attack might start. This is how hostilities might begin, with a surprise attack.
And diplomacy was still at play with Russia when they made that attack in 1904, very similar to what happened with the United States.
Indeed, yeah. I guess you could say it was a blueprint for Pearl Harbor in a lot of ways.
So part of the story that we hear about Pearl Harbor is that Japanese were attacking civilians. Is that part true?
Yes. I mean, it is true that some of the second wave attacks, the ones that I talked about that were so unsuccessful, in the second wave, they ran out of targets on the airfields because these airfields had been hit heavily, and they were now there's a lot of smoke in the area. So to get to the point, yes, there were instances when Japanese strafed civilian targets, like cars on roads, that kind of thing. But I forget the number of civilians killed during the battle, but there were scores of civilians killed, but they were killed primarily by American anti-aircraft ordnance that was shot up in the air and then came back down in populated areas. So the Japanese did not intend to kill civilians, but there was some collateral damage, as the common term is.
But the reporting that we heard, like in the newsreel, we heard a lot of reporting about how vicious and ruthless this attack was, and you have to wonder, like, the narrative that we have, that this was a highly orchestrated plan, flawlessly executed, a treacherous surprise attack, that this was the narrative that actually America embraced because of what happened at that day and getting America up on its feet into a war footing. We can talk about that some more when we come back from the break. If you got questions or comments about what really happened at Pearl Harbor, the number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and the source continues right after this.
Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
As you take time to support organizations that make a difference in your life and in our community, consider making a one-time gift to Texas Public Radio or becoming a sustaining supporter. No matter how you give, you help ensure that trustworthy news remains accessible to all. Listener support makes TPR possible. Together, we can keep this service strong. Give now at tpr.org, and thanks.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book Pearl Harbor, Japan's Greatest Disaster, a new look at a reframing of what happened on that day. We're joined by the author, naval historian Mark E. Steele. I do want to mention, on Saturday, there's going to be a ribbon cutting, a reopening of the George H.W. Bush Gallery at the National Museum of the Pacific War, which is in Fredericksburg, Texas, home of Admiral Nimitz. And that's going to be on Saturday at 10 a.m. And so people who are really into this historic event and this war, has an event for you to go check out. So Admiral Nimitz, what was he doing during Pearl Harbor?
He was not at Pearl Harbor because he was still back in Washington. So as most of your listeners know, the gentleman in charge of the Pacific Fleet was a guy named Admiral Husband E. Kimmel. He was in charge of the fleet when the attack took place. He was relieved on 17 December, and Nimitz was appointed to take over, and I think he actually took over on the last day of the year. So he was not involved in the attack or the weeks before the attack.
But he was handed, they said, your fleet's in shambles, but it was in better shape than we recognized?
Absolutely. So he was handed a fleet that had taken, to be fair, taken a lot of damage, and morale was low. I mean, they had been dealt a very heavy blow by the Japanese and caught totally by surprise. But when you look at the operational impact of the attack, it's a lot less than you might think. So there were 100 ships present in Pearl Harbor on the morning of the attack, and the Japanese sunk or damaged 18 of those. So that's hardly crippling losses. Of the 18, actually, all but three returned to service. And the Japanese, by design, focused on battleships. So there were 8 battleships present on the day, and all of these were sunk or damaged to some degree. So so had the Pacific War turned into a battleship war, then those losses may have been crippling. But, of course, it wasn't. The Pearl Harbor attack just showed that air power was going to be paramount in the war, not battleships. So sinking old battleships that couldn't even operate with the carrier fleet anyhow meant nothing. So this crippled fleet was able to assume the offensive as early as 1 February when it began a series of carrier raids against Japanese-held islands in the Pacific. And then in May, it repelled the Japanese, a major Japanese offensive in the Coral Sea. And then just 6 months later, the Pacific Fleet was able to sink 4 to 6 Pearl Harbor carriers at the Battle of Midway. So the fleet was not crippled. The fleet was able to perform its missions in the weeks and months after Pearl Harbor.
You have to marvel about how they got the Yorktown back in shape for Midway. Let's go to Richard, and Richard on the phone, and you're on the air, Richard.
Yes, I was just wondering about Japanese spies on Hawaii before the attack. Do we know much about that?
Thank you for the call. And so, Mark E. Steele.
That's a good question, and there were Japanese spies on Hawaii before the attack. In fact, they were led by an ex-Japanese naval officer who knew exactly what kind of information the Japanese planners needed. So the information that he gave the planners was crucial. It was excellent tactical level targeting information. So in general, it's fair to say that probably for the only time in the war, the Japanese won the intelligence war against the Americans. And obviously that was shown by the fact that they gained total surprise in the process.
Why was Japan so bad at their intelligence? And they had no idea that the U.S. had cracked their code and were able to tell exactly what they were up to. They should have known after the Battle of the Coral Sea that their communication channels were not secure.
Well, we could say that now, the Japanese Navy in particular just didn't value intelligence. They had disdain for intelligence. The personnel doing it weren't well trained. They weren't well regarded. And unlike in the American Navy, where intelligence drives operations, but just the opposite in the Japanese Navy, operations drove intelligence. So it wasn't valued. Now it's also important to note, though, that we were not able to read Japanese operational naval codes before Pearl Harbor. So that is why the Japanese were able to gain total surprise. We had no insight into their actual intentions.
So why didn't the people who were Japanese spies at Pearl Harbor, weren't they supposed to be targeting the aircraft carriers? Weren't the Japanese trying to take out the aircraft carriers, but they weren't in port at that time? Why couldn't they get that straight?
Well, the Japanese did a great job reporting this to their superiors. They reported in detail all the fleet movements in the months preceding the attack, and here's a fact that shows how shambolic Japanese planning was during the attack. So on 6 December, Japanese spies made their rounds. They were able to pass information back to Tokyo, which in turn was passed to the striking force, that's the carriers off Pearl Harbor, early in the morning of 7 December. And the information was that there were no carriers in Pearl Harbor. The carriers came and went with regularity, and at that point, on 6 December, they weren't present. So the Japanese did plan to heavily target the carriers, so they had planned to use a lot of their assets to hit the carriers, and they weren't there. Now, there's a chance they could have returned by 7 December, so that's what the Japanese hoped would happen. But as we know, hope is not really a good plan. So they didn't change the plan, and all these pilots who showed up with orders to target the aircraft carriers it was chaos when the carriers weren't there. So there's one example of how the attack was not well conducted.
So there is this, I'm trying to think of what are the lessons that we need to be learning from this new framework of Pearl Harbor. And it seems like the idea that, yes, it was clear and obvious to us now, and it was probably clear and obvious to people back then, that it would have been a mistake to attack Pearl Harbor by Japan, because it would have brought about the consequences that we experienced, eventually, the defeat of, of Japan. But that logic really didn't protect Pearl Harbor on that day. Recognizing that that would have been a mistake doesn't prevent you from when they make that mistake.
Right. And I think what we need to realize is that ill-conceived plans can have a tremendous implication. And Yamamoto was the guy behind the Pearl Harbor attack. Without him, there is no attack. So he had this unhealthy obsession that was really not questioned. It was not examined. And when the Japanese did it, it did not work out as he had hoped. It did not realize his objectives. And the Japanese paid a heavy price for his unhealthy obsession.
So what if Japan just went after the Dutch and British territories that were in the Pacific and avoided the Philippines and Hawaii and all those other things?
That's an excellent point, and that's probably one of the most critical what-ifs. And in fact, some people on the naval general staff, that was the superior command to Yamamoto and his combined fleet staff, they actually urged that the Japanese should go after the Netherlands and the British possessions and not attack the U.S. But in the mind of most Japanese leaders, though, all the Western powers there were linked strategically. So if you attack one, it was like attacking them all. But that just wasn't the case, though, because even as Franklin Roosevelt recognized at the time, he couldn't have brought the Americans into the war to defend a Dutch colony. It just wasn't going to happen. So obviously at some point, the U.S. and the Japanese were going to engage in hostilities in 1941, 1942 as war raged in the Pacific, but the Japanese should have done everything they could have to delay that from happening.
And you look at the brutality of the island hopping, fighting Hiroshima and all these other places, you know, in order to get that dedicated American response to fight, bit by bit on these beaches. If you didn't have Pearl Harbor, there probably would have been a negotiated peace.
Well, we do not know that, but there's more of a chance, obviously. But the Japanese, it was clear that they just did not understand the nature of the war they were embarking on. Some leaders understood the disparity in power between Japan and America, but Japanese leaders, and to include Yamamoto, who had disdain for the Americans, they just didn't respect America's ability to fight a war against a determined opponent like the Japanese.
What's the big lesson that you think people should be taking from this reframing of what happened at Pearl Harbor?
I would say that pretty much everything you know about the battle is a misunderstanding, at least, or mythology at worst. And that goes from the planning before the battle, the conduct of the actual attack, and the impact of the attack after the battle. So we need to reframe everything we know about Pearl Harbor.
But still, you know, there were these naval officers who were in command. They were relieved of command. Some said they were made scapegoats. They did not live. They were delivering a suboptimum, to their job, right?
They did not perform their job well. So I have a definite view on the role of Kimmel and Short. Kimmel and Short were the American commanders in Hawaii on the day of the attack. So this notion that they were not culpable is incorrect. Now, obviously, you should spread responsibility far and wide. There's a lot of blame to go around. Washington was also to blame in some regards, but the main part of the blame rests with Kimmel and Short.
Dereliction of duty, some people say.
Pearl Harbor, that was
Japan's greatest disaster, an incredible book, highly detailed, great information. You're not going to get it anywhere else. Mark E. Steele, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, David.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation. Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.